I don't know if anybody's ever asked you what your favorite subject is, whether it was in grade school or now in college. But one of my least favorite subjects in grade school, I'd have to say, would be history. I don't know if it was because I couldn't remember all the names and places and dates, but I just remember that I used to dread going to history class. Now, as I've gotten older, I've learned to appreciate history a little better, and I've realized that there's much more about history than just knowing the facts. There are things that we can appreciate about how we got to where we are today, and there are many lessons that we can learn from history. You've probably heard a quote along the lines of, "Those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it." And I think there's much truth in that statement. And the fact is that much of our Bible is recorded history for us. And in our passage today, Paul actually uses a historical account from the Old Testament to teach some lessons to the Corinthian church. So this morning, I'd like to look at a lesson on how to please the Lord from a nation that didn't. Found in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. If you would please turn there, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. The first 13 verses, if you'll follow along as I read. "Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant, how that all our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, neither be ye idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that ye may be able to bear it." A lesson on how to please the Lord from a nation that didn't. This morning I'd like to consider three stages to become servants who don't displease Him. Now I could have said that in the positive sense, three stages to become servants who do please Him. But I'm intentionally using the double negative there to emphasize an important fact. Now, this might sound a little profound, but I want you to capture this. It is impossible to be a servant who pleases Him if you are displeasing Him. I know that's one of those duh statements, right? Yet how often do we think or we walk around and claim that we're pleasing God, and yet we know there's an area in our lives that is displeasing Him? If there's any part of your life that is displeasing God, it is impossible to be a servant who pleases Him. So how do we become servants who don't displease Him? So our three stages to become servants who don't displease Him. First, stage one, we see the illustration of Israel in verses 1 through 5. Paul starts out by providing this history lesson to the Corinthian believers about the nation of Israel. And first we see the description of the illustration. Paul gives four descriptions in verses 1 through 4. First we see that all had the same surroundings. Verse 1 says, they were all under the cloud. Now, as we go through these points, I'm going to make reference to several Old Testament passages to give us a little more insight into this history lesson. And you don't have to turn there, but feel free to make note of these references as I've given them to you. They were all under the cloud. Exodus 13:21. We're all familiar with this account. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. So they all had the same surroundings. They were all surrounded by God's presence, leading the way for the nation of Israel. Now, I don't know about you, but there are some days I think it would sure be nice if God would just be there in a pillar of cloud or fire to show me the direction I need to go. But thankfully, we have something that they didn't have. We have the Holy Spirit, and we have God's Word to guide us. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. So Paul starts out with this description. They all had the same surroundings. They were all under the cloud. Secondly, they all went through the same circumstances. He says they all passed through the sea. Exodus 14:21-22. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Now, unfortunately, there have been some that have tried to explain how this happened in natural ways, how under the right circumstances and in the right location, a wind might blow back the water and cause a piece of dry land to appear. And perhaps that's how the Lord decided to do it. But I prefer to believe that this was nothing short of a supernatural event, a miracle of God. And when it says there was a wall of water on their left and on their right, I take that pretty literally. And I'm sure this must have been an amazing experience as the entire nation walks through the sea. So they all went through the same circumstances. They all had the same supervisor. This third description in verse 2. It says they were all baptized unto Moses. You know, I'm sure the experiences of being guided by the cloud and miraculously passing through the Red Sea had the effect of uniting them to their leader, Moses. Imagine the faith and trust they put in this guy as he raises his arms and tells the people to walk through the sea. I'm sure this was a uniting experience and put a deep connection and commitment to their new supervisor, Moses. And then fourthly, they had the same sustenance. In verses 3 and 4, it says they all ate the same spiritual meat and drank the same spiritual drink. Firstly, I think they had the same physical sustenance. Again, we're familiar with the story, and I think this reference to it being a spiritual meat and a spiritual drink is drawing attention to its heavenly source. As God provided the manna and water as they needed, even Moses declared, "This is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat." God not only was their deliverer from bondage in Egypt, but he was their provider and sustainer. So they had the same physical sustenance, but they also had the same spiritual sustenance. Paul goes on to say, "For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." In my study, I found out that there's actually a Jewish tradition that says there was a physical rock that followed the nation of Israel through the wilderness. Now, I don't know if that's true or if this verse supports that idea. But the fact is that the people all shared of the same spiritual sustenance. And so we've seen in the description of this illustration that they had the same surroundings, the same circumstances, the same supervisor, and the same sustenance. Now, I could pause here to point out the striking similarity between this description and the description of being a student here at ABC. Same surroundings, same circumstances, same supervisors, same sustenance. We all eat the same food. But that might be stretching a little bit of what I'm trying to draw here. Now, you would think after this description that our second point might be that there would be the delight of the illustration or the devotion in the illustration. But unfortunately, that is not the case. Secondly, we see the displeasure in the illustration in verse 5. But with many of them, God was not well pleased. Although God had given them such amazing manifestations of His power and His goodness towards them, the majority of them failed to enter the promised land. Many of them, I think, is an understatement. Numbers 14, 29 and 30, the Lord said, "Your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and all that were numbered of you, according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upward, which have murmured against me. Doubtless ye shall not come into the land, concerning which I swear to make you dwell therein, save Caleb and Joshua." Everyone 20 and up, except for two, would die in the wilderness because of God's displeasure. Though all of Israel had the same surroundings, the same circumstances, the same supervisor, the same sustenance, though they all had this common share in the blessing of God, they were not all pleasing to God. So that's a great history lesson of Israel. But what's the point? Paul tells us in verses 6 through 10 why he gives this illustration of Israel, which leads to our second stage, the intention of the illustration in verses 6 through 10. Paul wanted them to be an example to the Corinthians so that they could learn how to please the Lord in their obedience. And also, I believe, to recognize how seriously God takes sin. I think oftentimes we are so quick to focus on God's love and mercy, and yet we fail to focus on God's righteousness and justice. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm thankful for God's mercy. I need it just as much as anyone else. But that doesn't give us a license to sin. And we need to recognize how God views sin. And in verses 6 through 10, Paul gives five specific examples of Israel's sin. And as we will see, there were often grave consequences for that sin. So the first intention that Paul gives in this illustration is that we should avoid coveting in verse 6. Now, these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Avoid coveting. Now, we don't know exactly what account Paul may be referring to here, but perhaps it was Numbers 11, 4 through 6, that says, "In the mixed multitude that was among them fell a lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes.'" So the people were lusting after food they didn't have. Now, of course, they failed to remember the fact that they were slaves and enforced labor in Egypt. All they remember is the food that they miss. Well, what was God's response? "And there went forth a wind from the Lord and brought quails from the sea and let them fall by the camp, as it were a day's journey on this side, and as it were on a day's journey the other side, round about the camp, and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. And the people stood up all that day and all that night and all the next day, and they gathered the quails. He that gathered the least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp." So we're talking 3 feet high of quail. The guy that gathered the least amount gathered 30 bushels of quail. They were in quail heaven, I guess. So ultimately, God gave them what they wanted, what they were coveting, but at what cost? "And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, ere it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, And the Lord smote the people with a very great plague. And he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people that lusted. The name of that place literally means graves of craving. So the first intent that Paul gives from this illustration is that we should avoid coveting. If you will, guard your passions. What is it that you find yourself constantly wanting or lusting after? Be careful. God may very well give it to you. The second intent is that we should avoid counterfeiting. Neither be ye idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play in verse 7. So Paul is making a reference to an account that I think most of us are familiar with. We remember the golden calf in Exodus 32, and Moses is up on the mountain getting the commandments from God, and the people get tired of waiting, and they convince Aaron to make an idol because they wanted their own gods to go before them. A counterfeit, if you will, of the one true God that had delivered them from Egypt. And so what was God's response to this sin? Exodus 32:10, "Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation." God wanted to wipe them all out and start over. But Moses interceded for the people and asked the Lord not to destroy them. But when Moses saw what the people had done, he realized why God was so angry with them. He threw down the tablets, destroyed the golden calf, ground it up into a powder, put it in their water supply, and made them drink it. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together unto him. And he said unto them, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, put every man his sword by his side, and go in and out from the gate, from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay every man his brother, and every man his companion, and every man his neighbor." And the children of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. You think God takes sin pretty seriously? The biblical accounts of idolatry are probably foreign to most of us, particularly here in America. I doubt any of you got up this morning and bowed down to some wooden idol in your room. At least I hope not. We have bigger issues if we did. But if your time or your thought or your energy is given to anything that should be given to God, then that has become your idol. How often do we put more focus or we attribute more worth to a counterfeit God in place of the one true God? I'd like to suggest that we need to guard our priorities. Guard your priorities. Make sure that Christ is preeminent in your life. Avoid counterfeiting. Thirdly, we need to avoid carnality in verse 8. "Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed." This example comes from Numbers 25. "And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab." Again, we see God's response in Numbers 25, verses 4 through 9. "And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. I doubt there would be too many of us in this room that would be ready to describe yourself as a fornicator. You know, but fornication isn't just an action issue. It's a heart issue. Matthew says that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. You know, God takes this stuff very seriously. And if you're involved in a relationship you shouldn't be, if you're crossing the line with your boyfriend or girlfriend, if you're looking at stuff you shouldn't be, if you're thinking about stuff you shouldn't be, you are committing fornication. And I know that sounds pretty harsh and direct, but this is serious stuff. And if you're caught up in this kind of sin, you are displeasing God. For this example, I'd like to suggest we need to guard our purity. In a day of unbridled impurity and sensuality in our society, we need divine, brave, and unwavering determination to be pure for Christ. So may we avoid carnality. Fourthly, we need to avoid chiding Christ. In verse 9, avoid chiding Christ. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. This idea of tempting Christ means to try, as in the people were trying the patience of God. As we see in Numbers 21, where the people journeyed from Mount Hor by way of the Red Sea, and the people spake against God and against Moses, "Wherefore have ye brought us out of Egypt to die in this wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread." And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. You know, this idea of chiding is to express disapproval of, to blame, to harass, to nag. Do you ever find yourself blaming God for your circumstances? Do you find yourself harassing or nagging Him? God, why are you doing this to me? This isn't what I wanted for my life. I deserve better than this. I'd like to suggest that for this intent, we need to guard our pride. You know, when we disapprove of something that God is doing in our lives, we are ultimately saying, God, I know better than you. I have a better way for my life. Be careful to guard your pride and avoid chiding Christ. And then the final intention that Paul gives is that we need to avoid complaining in verse 10. Neither murmur ye, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, there are several occasions that we've already seen in which Israel was murmuring and complaining. But the one I'd like to focus your attention on is in Numbers 16. And in this account, we find Korah leading a group of 250 who were rebelling against Moses and Aaron and challenging their right to lead and claiming they were just as holy as Moses and Aaron were. And just as we've seen with the other sins, the Lord didn't take too kindly to them. And he caused the ground to open up and swallow them up, their houses and all their possessions. And apparently some of the Israelites disagreed with this punishment. In Numbers 16:41, "But on the morrow all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, Ye have killed the people of the Lord. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Get you up from among this congregation, that I may consume them as in a moment. And they fell upon their faces. And Moses said unto Aaron, Take a censer, and put fire therein from off the altar, and put on incense, and go quickly into the congregation, and make an atonement for them. For there is wrath gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun. And Aaron took, as Moses commanded, and ran into the midst of the congregation. And behold, the plague was begun among the people. And he put on incense and made an atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed. Now they that died in the plague were 14,700, besides them that died about the matter of Korah." Now you have to picture this. All the people of Israel are out there complaining and murmuring against Moses. And the Lord's wrath is turned against them, and they just began to fall. And Moses tells Aaron, "Quick! Run out and make an atonement for the people." And the people are just falling and dying until it gets to Moses or to Aaron as he's offering up this incense to the Lord. And there's Aaron standing between the dead and the living. We need to avoid complaining. Nearly 15,000 people died because of their murmuring and complaining. For this intent, I'd like to suggest something to guard that's probably a new word to some of you. You need to guard your priggishness. To be priggish is to display or demand of others pointlessly precise conformity. To be fussy about trivialities, especially in a self-righteous or irritating manner? Are you a murmurer? Are you constantly complaining about the rules or about the food or about this class or that instructor? Are you the one that always has something negative to say? Be careful. God has given us an example of what he thinks about complainers. So the intention of the illustration has been to give us some examples of how we should behave to avoid displeasing God. And verse 11 reiterates this for us. Now all these things happened unto them for examples, or for an example, and they are written for our admonition. These things have been written down for us, so let us take these examples to heart. We need to strive to avoid coveting and guard our passions. We need to avoid counterfeiting and guard our priorities. Avoid carnality and guard our purity. Avoid chiding Christ and guard our pride. And avoid complaining and guard our priggishness. Now, examples are great, but how do I actually apply these lessons in my own life? Well, thankfully, Paul gives us some practical steps to follow, which leads us to stage three, the implementation of the intention, in verses 12 through 14. And we could have a whole sermon just on these few verses, but I'd like you to remember three easy steps on how to implement the lessons learned in avoiding sin and pleasing God. First, look out and take heed. In verse 12, wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. You know, the first basic step in avoiding sin is to never trust your flesh. No one is exempt from the possibility of any of these sins that we just looked at. And as soon as you think, I would never do that, be careful. Look out and take heed. Then the second step is to look up and take comfort. In the first part of verse 13, there hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able. I think the word temptation has come to mean something pretty negative to us today. But I think we tend to look at the word in the wrong way. You know, temptation in and of itself is not sin. It's something we all face. This verse says it's common to man. And while temptation can lead to sin, it also provides an opportunity to trust the Lord and recognize that he will never give us more than we can handle. You know, Caleb and Joshua faced the same temptations that the other spies faced, but they trusted in God, and they were the only two of their generation that were allowed into the promised land. Oswald Chambers put it pretty bluntly when he said, if you are debating as to whether or not God can deliver you from sin, then either let him do it or tell him that he cannot. We need to look up and take comfort. And then we need to look around and take off. But will with the temptation also make a way to escape that ye may be able to bear it. This word escape has the sense of an army that's trapped up in a mountain. And the enemy is right on top of them, and they think they have nowhere to go, and then all of a sudden, they see this mountain pass as a way to escape from the enemy. And as you find yourself facing temptations or trials, be looking around for the way to escape. And when the Lord shows it to you, take off through that mountain pass so that you can overcome in victory. God will, with the temptation, also make a way to escape. So the implementation of the intention of the illustration of Israel, look out and take heed. Look up and take comfort. Look around and take off. I recently had a situation where there were some little critters getting into a bag of my dog food that I keep in my garage. And I don't have the luxury to be handing out free meals, so I decided to get a large plastic Tupperware to put my dog food in. You know, the one where the handles kind of clamp up and lock in the lid, and so I thought this was going to be a pretty good solution, and I get up the next morning to feed my dogs, and would you believe there's a mouse standing on one of the handles, because I'd left one handle down, because sure enough, they're not going to be able to lift the lid. So one mouse is standing on the handle, kind of pushing up into the crack of the lid, and there's two other mice standing on top, cheering him on. Yeah, you can do it. Keep pushing. They obviously weren't very smart, because they're standing on the lid the guy's trying to lift. So I think, okay, well, I don't think he can lift the lid, but just to be safe, I went ahead and closed that second latch. Well, I get up the next morning. There they are on top of the lid. This time they're chewing a hole through the lid. And so that was enough for me. Okay, Google, how do you deal with a bunch of mice? And I came across this handy little invention called the plank. And you just attach this to a bucket and put a little peanut butter or something out on the end. And it has a little magnet so that as the mouse climbs up on it and he thinks he's pretty secure, but then as he gets to the end, all of a sudden that magnet tension releases and down goes the mouse into the bucket. And it resets itself, ready for the next mouse. You know, and as I saw this trap, I thought, you know, this reminds me a lot of how temptation works. You know, we see this sin out on the edge, and we kind of get a little bit closer, you know. Well, I'm not going to fall into that sin. But we start inching our way out. And we feel pretty secure. And we think, hey, I can handle this. But as we get to the end, and we pass that point of no return, and now we've fallen into that sin, and at this point, our sin has become very displeasing to God. It is impossible to be a servant who pleases Him if you are displeasing Him. I hope that you will learn this lesson on how to please the Lord from a nation that didn't.